Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. The U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, 20 years later, got a lot of attention this week. We will discuss media coverage then and now. In the run-up to the invasion, the majority of the U.S. media went along with the Bush administration's fabricated claims about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and its links to 9/11. But in the months before the U.S. invasion, reporters in Knight Ridder's D.C. bureau were the only ones questioning the case for war. So why did the U.S. media help the Bush administration sell the invasion to the American people? What does the coverage then and now say about the role of journalists in distinguishing fact from propaganda? And how did the invasion and occupation of Iraq change Iraqi society, the country's economy, and politics? Jonathan Lande is an award-winning D.C. national security correspondent for Reuters. When the U.S. invaded Iraq, Jonathan Lande was working for Knight Ridder. Knight Ridder's reporting was the subject of Buying the War, a Bill Moyers documentary about the few journalists who got it right in the lead-up to the invasion when they questioned the true nature of the Bush administration's justifications for the invasion. The feature film, Shock and Awe, also focuses on the Knight Ridder journalists who questions claims made by George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, and others. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks so much for joining us again.
My pleasure.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Adel Iskandar, Associate Professor of Global Communication at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. He's the author, co-author, and editor of several books, including Egypt in Flux, Essays on an Unfinished Revolution, and Al Jazeera, the story of the network that is rattling governments and redefining modern journalism. Adel Iskandar is also media co-editor of Jadalia. Hi, Adel. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have both of you. We have been listening and watching a lot of the coverage. Obviously, we didn't see it all. But the one question I'm not really hearing this week is, why did the U.S. invade Iraq? And I know, Jonathan, you've been on a couple of panels looking back, and I just wonder, 20 years later, how are you answering that question?
I mean, it's a question that has been asked ever since the Bush administration began whipping up the American public for the invasion of Iraq, and has been asked ever since. And I mean, I don't think that there's any definitive answers to that. But I think that you have to break it down into the people who were involved at the very top of the administration. I think there was a confluence of interests. I'm starting at the very top with George W. Bush. He was in office when 9/11 happened. He saw it as his duty following that to rid the world of dictators and who were amassing weapons of mass destruction and who might be in league with extremists, which, of course, you know, in the case of Saddam Hussein, was not true. Yet this is what they used as their justification to invade Iraq. Also, let's not forget, he accused Saddam of trying to kill his father. And then you move down the level to Cheney and Rumsfeld, two cold warriors who saw 9/11 perhaps as a challenge to American supremacy in the world, and decided they had to go out and show other countries that you can't do this to us and get away with it. We have to also remember that the invasion strategy was hinged on a man named Chalabi, Ahmad Chalabi, who was the head of the Iraqi National Congress, who was kind of at the center of the administration's plans to replace Saddam Hussein, Chalabi had promised two things. One, he would allow American military bases in Iraq. And two, he would forge diplomatic relations with Israel. And this appealed to the next rung of people down the ladder, who, for some unknown reason, thought that by invading Iraq, the United States could plant democracy in the Middle East, and that would make the region safe for Israel. Now, you know, I can't go beyond those observations as to motives behind the invasion, but that's what appeared to us at Knight Ridder, myself, Warren Strobel, John Walcott, and the late Joe Galloway, when we were reporting out the stories that we were reporting.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, Nabil? How do you, I'm sorry, Adil, how do you answer that question, why the U.S. invaded Iraq?
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Rose. And thanks to Jonathan for really sort of setting the stage and explaining the circumstances up to that point. I'm in agreement with everything that Jonathan said. I would add a couple of more points that might add some additional context. The first is, this is the post 9/11 period. This is a time where the populace in the United States is confused. They're being whipped into a frenzy. The Bush administration is describing all of its nemesis or any adversary anywhere in the world as a potential target, that terrorists will be pursued everywhere and anywhere. There's a war on terror that's been launched. There are axes of evil. So the language that's being articulated in the media is that we will go after everyone and anyone who is a potential adversary. It was much easier to identify existing regimes where there's a bedrock of criticism that has been spent for quite some time. And Saddam Hussein was a very, very easy target in that regard. But I would like to add as well that Dick Cheney, as Jonathan mentioned, is a critical part of this whole puzzle, not only because he served a prominent role in the cabinet, but he was also a major executive in Halliburton, which had significant assets in excavation and exploration of oil, not just in the region, but around the world. And arguably, there are connections that we later discovered between Halliburton's operations in the Gulf, as well as in Iraq and the war. Now, some at the time were like, this is very conspiratorial, it's a big problem, but a lot of those bids and a lot of those contracts ended up going to Halliburton anyway. And so having said that, there was obviously an economic motivation anchored into that. I would also add that one of the main justifications for that was what was described at the time as intelligence reporting. And there's a general understanding that intelligence agencies serve the national interests of those respective countries, whether those happen to be the United States or the UK. And so the public generally isn't scrupulous or scrutinizing of intelligence agencies. The assumption is that they're doing the hard work in everybody's interest. But in reality, it appeared as though many of those intelligence reports were, in one way or another, either manipulated or, as the British media described them, as kind of sexed up. There was a dossier where there were exaggerations, PhD theses that were taken out of context, all to create a justification. So it's fairly clear to the administration at the time that they were making a case despite not having a strong bedrock of clear evidence to explain why a war in Iraq was imminent and important at that particular moment. So, which of course raises the question of what are the true, quote unquote, true motivations behind the war? And, you know, we lived to kind of see the consequences of that, and things really didn't go as well as was suspected. There were stories about how the Iraqis would greet, you know, American troops and allied troops with flowers and hugs, and, you know, it couldn't be farther from the truth. But a lot of this ended up being a media war, which I think is what set the stage for that. It started off as a media justification for war and then turned into a media war that quickly unraveled.
Jonathan, what was it about your team at Knight Ridder that questioned what the Bush administration was saying that questioned the justification. Your colleague, you just mentioned Warren Strobel, who's now a national security reporter with the Wall Street Journal, recently said that very soon after 9/11, he found out that the Bush administration was considering not just Afghanistan, but also looking at Iraq in terms of military and diplomatic options. This was long before they started making their case for the invasion. But the very fact that they were considering Iraq as a potential target made no sense to me, said Warren Strobel. So Iraq was part of a bigger regional plan. Can you talk more about this? And was this widely known among the D.C. press corps?
So it was Warren's initial reporting that got us started on this. In fact, it was actually on September 12th, the day after the attacks on the United States by Al-Qaeda, that Warren came back to the Bureau and called me into John Walcott's office and said, they're talking, that there's been this principals meeting at the National Security Council, and they're not just talking about Afghanistan, they're talking about Iraq. And we looked at each other and all of us said, WTF, why are they talking about Iraq in the context of the World Trade Center attacks and the attack on the Pentagon? Because this was it had been established that it was Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, we know, was based in Afghanistan. We knew of no connection between that and Saddam Hussein. It made no sense, as he said, because, Saddam Hussein was a secular leader, Arab leader, who was the very kind of secular Arab leader that Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden were dedicated to toppling and replacing. So from there, we started hearing what the people I called the fellow travelers, people who supported the administration from the outside in the commentariat. Talking about how this couldn't have been done by Al-Qaeda alone. They had to have had support from a state. And then we started hearing that state was Iraq. And then we started hearing the administration making this case that Saddam had hidden his weapons of mass destruction programs from, at that time, the most intense intrusive UN weapons inspection that had ever been mounted. Plus, the United States and its allies had Iraq under a microscope. And we were supposed to believe the United States was, Americans were being told, the world was being told by the administration that not only had Saddam Hussein managed to preserve his weapons of mass destruction programs, but that he could make an alliance with Osama bin Laden and give him weapons of mass destruction for use against the United States. Well, that didn't make sense either, because Saddam Hussein was not going to give the crown jewels of his military force to a Sunni extremist group that was dedicated on overthrowing dictators like him. And so, that's where our reporting took us, basically.
Jonathan Lande is an award-winning D.C. national correspondent for Reuters. When the U.S. invaded Iraq, Jonathan was working for Knight Ridder. They were some of the few journalists who actually got it right by just asking questions and doing good old-fashioned journalism. In fact, Jonathan, you have said that you all had a rule. You had a two-source rule. You would not write something you could not get two sources on.
That's correct. I mean, that's basic journalism, but we had a couple of others. We were guided by the idea that, Knight Ridder owned 32 newspapers. They were not in New York or Washington or L.A. or, where the power centers of the United States. We wrote for newspapers that were scattered around the United States, some in major cities. But our rule was that we don't write for the people who send other other people's sons and daughters to war. We write for the people whose sons and daughters get sent to war. And so our audience, the way we saw it, were the families of the soldiers and the soldiers themselves who were going to be sent to war. And we followed that. And the other rule was, when the government says something, our job is to ask, is this true? One of the things I do need to go back to, and I want to make this point, that the American intelligence community got the weapons of mass destruction part of this completely wrong. But the thing they did get right was they assessed that on a number of occasions that Saddam Hussein was not involved in 9/11, and that it was highly unlikely that he would give his any of his weapons of mass destruction, which actually didn't exist, to Al-Qaeda. That part of the intelligence assessment was never used by the Bush administration, was actually rejected by the Bush administration because it didn't fit their the sales campaign that they were mounting to convince Americans that that Iraq needed to be invaded. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what we reported, because this was a primary example of the cherry picking that the Bush administration relied on to make its case for war.
It was so interesting to learn just briefly, Jonathan, in a recent talk you gave, you said some of the Knight Ridder newspapers refused to run your stories at that time because what you, your team, was reporting was not being reported in the New York Times, the Post, or on the major TV networks.
That's absolutely true. And in fact, one of the Knight Ridder newspapers, and I'm not going to say which one, there was a senior editor at a major Knight Ridder newspaper who not only questioned what we were reporting because it hadn't been in the New York Times or the Washington Post or on TV, but he assigned several journalists at his paper to go delve into our reporting, the reporting by his own colleagues, and whether or not what we were reporting and how we were reporting it was accurate. Hmm.
Jonathan Lande is a reporter with Reuters who used to work with Knight Ridder. Adil Iskandar is Associate Professor of Global Communications at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, the author of several books, including Egypt in Flux, Essays on an Unfinished Revolution. We're getting a lot of emails already, so if you'd like to give us a call, questions for our guests, thoughts about media coverage of this invasion then and now, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. You can also tweet us. We're at Your Call Radio. Adil, Jonathan just talked briefly about Ahmad Chalabi, who at the time was the head of the Iraqi National Congress. Can you just remind us, because we're getting a few emails actually about Chalabi, remind us of who he was and then what he did at the time. He often fed the same information to the Pentagon and to the press, which made some journalists think that they did, in fact, have two sources.
Absolutely. So Ahmad Chalabi is an Iraqi descendant who had been residing in the U.S. for a substantial period of time. He had been fashioned by a group of individuals close to him and close to his family in Washington, D.C., as the forthcoming leader of an independent democratic Iraq. And that is precisely how he described himself. That's the manner in which he rolled around the Beltway and befriended major interest groups. So he was really kind of a smooth operator in D.C. circles. And he was basically feeding both the administration and policymakers on both ends of the aisle the same information. Everybody needed and wanted to hear that Iraq would be an quote unquote independent democratic state that is friendly to U.S. interests, where the oil would flow freely and would no longer pose a threat neither to the United States' interests nor to its allies in the region. And in the process, he was able to amass a significant amount of both money and political capital in Washington, D.C., and to render himself really the only viable alternative in the eyes of the Bush administration and those within those circles. He also knew how to speak the language of, you know, U.S. national defense and U.S. national interests. And so he was the right person in the right place at the right time. The Bush administration was, as Jonathan implied, I'm not putting words into Jonathan's mouth, but I will describe it differently, but they were firing on all cylinders. They were looking for, you know, adversaries everywhere. And so when Iraq was on that map of places to pursue and to sort of actualize this regime change plan, Ahmad Chalabi was right there in the waiting. And he has been groomed, arguably, for at least a decade prior. And so he stepped into that discussion, provided what was then described as, you know, local information. Of course, he has his own minders, his own connections in the country, but all of whom are extremely politicized and were essentially telling the administration what they wanted to hear to create a justification for war. So all of these resources that had once been marshaled to pursue, you know, Al-Qaeda or sort of these terrorist networks were now being shifted quite substantially towards regime change in Iraq, with Ahmad Chalabi being in the position of the leader or president in waiting once the Saddam Hussein government fell. So that's how he played that role. And it was lots of information. Not only was he quoted, but other folks who were part of his, you know, cohort also became notable names because they were giving interviews, they were in the press, and they were Iraqis. And that is a critical sort of determinant, that because they were Iraqi, they gave a rubber stamp, or they gave authenticity and reliability to the argument that the Bush administration was pushing forward, that Iraq is the number one target at this particular point. And of course, at a time where, you know, the idea of terrorism is very nebulous, it's very decentralized, the adversary is all over the place, it was much easier to put a target sign on Iraq, on Saddam Hussein, and Ahmad Chalabi was the man to step into that role.
I think it's important that we just need sure. to note that Chalabi died in 2015. He is no longer with us.
I was going to ask you about that. You know, we have just a few minutes left for this particular segment, but I think it's important to point out, Jonathan, you have also said in talks that you have been on the front lines of Iraq, Afghanistan, and Ukraine. And you say that as a war correspondent, your job is to report on the people on the receiving end of the U.S. policy, on the receiving end of bombs. And when you look back 20 years ago, other than people like Ahmad Chalabi, you rarely heard about Iraqis and what this would actually do to Iraq. I mean, most people really didn't even know anything about Iraq, Jonathan. So can you talk about that when you look back 20 years ago? I mean, the coverage this week, Iraqi voices are all over the place. That was not the case 20 years ago.
Well, I mean, 20 years ago, Iraqis were living in an incredibly repressive dictatorship where there was no free speech. And so it was nearly impossible for you know, ordinary Iraqis to talk about the circumstances in which they were living, unless they were, of course, Iraqi Kurds, where, you know, and I was able to go to Iraqi Kurdistan 4 months before the U.S. invasion and spend time 4 months up there. The care of the Iranians let me cross their border into northern Iraq. And I spent the first, you know, 4 months before the war reporting on the situation there. And one has to remember that there were Iraqi voices that were able to speak. We learned about Saddam Hussein's use of chemical weapons against his own people from the Iraqi Kurds. But back here, there may well have been a dearth of, in much of the media, of voices, Iraqi voices, who expressing concern and about the consequences of a U.S. invasion. I have to say that one of the stories that really brought that helped us help Warren and I do our job. We did a story early on about the implications of invading Iraq and what could happen, including the eruption of a civil war. And fighting between Iraq's minority Sunnis who were in power and majority Shia who were out of power, and that story prompted one of someone to come forward to us from the Pentagon, who became one of our best sources because they had read this story and said, "You're absolutely right. That's what could well happen, and that's not what is being looked at or considered within the Pentagon or within the administration. I'm so glad you guys are doing this." And as I said, that story, the story on what could happen if the United States invaded, really was instrumental in helping us acquire a very, very important source who had informed the rest of our reporting.
Adil, what would you add?
I would add that, first of all, I do want to express my admiration for the work that Jonathan and the team had done back then, because they were really swimming against the tide and bore the brunt of a lot of criticism. Now we may be celebrating the work that they've done, but at the time they were really vilified for that work. So I just wanted to express that admiration. But also the other thing that I would add is that what the Iraq War gave us is a very, very kind of scary and ominous approach to journalism, which is at the time being described as embedded reporting. So the argument was that if journalists want to be safe going into a war zone, that they need to team up with the military establishment, with the forces on the ground. And in doing so, they actually end up seeing the world through the lens of those who are waging the war, as opposed to those who are on the receiving end of that munition, the victims of the war. And so that contributed to the disappearance of Iraqi voices as well. And so it took a lot out of, journalists who had, I would add another sort of value-laden term and say a real conscience to go on and speak to Iraqis to see what the consequences of this war might have been. And of course, we know that hundreds of thousands of Iraqis were either killed or maimed or displaced as a result of the first wave of the war, not to mention the ensuing civil war. And it has taken a long time for that reporting to come through. Today, because of those 20 years, we've come a full circle, and we could see how not only poorly conceived and poorly executed the discussion and the lead up to the war has been. The justifications were on poor ground. The intelligence was not correct, and the manner in which it was done has basically decimated a nation. And Iraq is nowhere near where it was expected to be, or at least the arguments made by the Bush administration at the time, as it is now. And when the U.S. when the U.S. troops were eventually withdrawn, they were withdrawn out of a country that was, for all intents and purposes, a failed state run by communities of warlords and foreign intervention. And so we're not in a better place, unfortunately, because of the war. And luckily, we have the reporting of Jonathan and the team at Knight Ridder and a few others across the country and internationally who dared to push the boundaries and really create a true record of what should have been done at the time, and calling into question the kind of mainstream reporting that robbed us of the truth. We luckily have that on record, and we can celebrate it now and hopefully not make that mistake in the future.
Adil Iskandar is Associate Professor of Global Communications at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, the author of many books, including Al Jazeera, The Story of the Network That is Rattling Governments and Redefining Modern Journalism. Adil, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Lande is an award-winning D.C. national security correspondent for Reuters. When the U.S. invaded Iraq, Jonathan was working for Knight Ridder. Knight Ridder's reporting was the subject of Buying the War, a Bill Moyers documentary about the few journalists who got it right in the lead-up to the invasion. The feature film Shock and Awe also focuses on Knight Ridder journalists who questioned the claims made by people like George W. Bush, Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, and others. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will be joined by Nabil Salah, a scholar of Iraqi politics and social movements and an independent journalist. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. We continue our discussion about the invasion and occupation of Iraq with independent journalist Nabil Salah. In a recent article in the Left East magazine, he asks, who tells the story of Iraq? The victims and the survivors, or the tourist reporters and the rulers enthroned by unpunished war criminals from Downing Street and the Beltway? America's war against Iraq was not a single explosion in time that happened in a distant then. It is here with us. We can still hear the sirens. Nabil Salah is an Iraqi poet, journalist, and photographer. His works, including the Baghdad Walk series, appeared in publications including Jadalia and Al Jazeera English, and is translated to Italian, Spanish, and French. Hi, Nabil. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, Nabil. The piece you wrote was just so beautiful and just really piercing. The last time we had you on was in 2019 during the mass anti-government protests in Iraq. And this 20 years after the invasion, it's getting a lot of attention. We're hearing a lot about the legacy of the invasion and its aftermath. And we're noticing that so many more Iraqi voices are in the media and writing articles. I just wonder, what are your thoughts about what you have read and heard this week, 20 years later?
Well, first, which Iraqis are speaking? This is an important question to ask. Yes, there are so many Iraqis are speaking, and many of them are great. And I'm inspired by them, and I learn from them. But also not many from inside Iraq are speaking. One of your guests mentioned earlier that Iraqis under Saddam Hussein couldn't speak freely. True, but it's still true today. We have a regime that is equally repressive and oppressive, and keeping the society on mute, although the society is fighting back. What I have been reading is, alternates between revisionism and normalization. Some people are still advocating for the crime. They don't even call it a mistake. And even those who call it a mistake, this makes us think that this implies naivete at the decision-making level, miscalculations that could be understood and perhaps forgiven, but the acts were predatory, in fact. You have, for example, months when the conflict in Ukraine erupted, Dave Phillips in the New York Times wrote that U.S. veterans were trying to spread democracy in places that had only a tepid interest in it. And then they went to fight in Ukraine. Of course, Ukraine is more appreciative of democracy. You have people like Lulu Garcia Navarro, and it's horrendous. And it's surprising how people who spent decades and so many years on what they call the field still write things that are completely detached with reality and with the people that where they lived. For example, she injects her own PTSD in the middle of the piece 20 years after. Can we speak about our PTSD? She cites veterans committing suicide, but gives no equal attention to Iraqis leaping from bridges into the drying rivers of the Tigris and the Euphrates, and their bodies is swept by the tide and found towns downstream. And she ends her piece with a quote that is sympathetic with George W. Bush. How can you do that? Hmm. It's difficult to conjure adequate words in the presence of such revisionism, to put it nicely. But it's also important to remember that even the greats, or for example, take John Burns, called the Dean of Foreign Correspondence in the United States, and an embedded page 161. He writes that this war could have been justified anytime on the basis of human rights alone. This person has been to the Balkans, to China, and is worshipped. He was, of course, a bureau chief in Baghdad. So what I see today is just a continuation of a pattern that that has existed and has been static, unfortunately. We see some good reporting from a few individuals who are getting better and better. These days we saw some good reporting from the Washington Post, from Mustafa Salim and Louisa Lovelock, but you know, for example, in the Associated Press, there are tourist reporters who go to Fallujah and don't even mention the birth defects. How can you do that? This is how we see wars' afterlives that are still embroidered with ours. You know, the war hasn't ended, and I was hesitant to write anything because I don't really accept the narrative that we commemorate an anniversary. You know, the war is with us. You know, the sirens are still wailing in our heads, and this is how it is.
You know, to your point about Fallujah, you just reminded me of, in fact, we're going to have Ferhat Alani on the show. He was on Democracy Now! This week, and he said 1 in 5 babies are born with deformities in Fallujah. This is one of the most terrible consequences of the U.S. invasion.
So actually, it started before, you know, in 1991 in the Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm, that's how it is called in the Empire. So the first use of depleted uranium, which is a nuclear waste byproduct developed during the Cold War, as the United States was looking for alternative heavy metals and alloys for the purpose of penetrating Soviet armors. And they only used it after the Iron Curtain collapsed. So after explosion, these particles of depleted uranium live in water and soil, enter the food chain, and can travel with the air for kilometers. And if you look at the Fallujah birth defects, there is a Twitter account that keeps being blocked, and they come back, and this is what war is. We have babies are born dead today. Women burying their 1 day old children that they cannot even recognize how their faces look. You know, with spina bifida, with clips and all sorts of deformities. It's important to remember that there is a football field where children are buried. It's called the Martyrs Cemetery. It's where children in past lives used to play football, and now they don't play anymore because it's their burial place. I once wrote that the sites of beautiful memories are forever soaked in war. This is what it means. And it's important also to remember, as Carly Krakow reported in Al Jazeera, is that on August 10, I think 2022, the United States President Joe Biden, a warmonger himself, signed the PACT Act, aiding 3.5 million veterans who suffer from conditions linked to burn pits in Iraq and Afghanistan. But of course, no mention of Iraqis. This is the United States Empire.
Right. And of course, you know that it took John Stewart to get involved to get that passed. Otherwise, it probably would not have passed. It's been years. And we're going to do another show about that. We had Dr. Kali Rubai on the show talking about how those burn pits affect Iraqis. And we're going to do another show about that. Can you talk to us, Nabil, to go even further back, because in the independent media, the sanctions are being mentioned this week. I haven't really heard them discussed in more of the mainstream outlets. So can you just remind us, the UN imposed these sanctions, what you call a regime of humanitarian starvation. This began in 1991. Is that right?
Yeah, so I would love to step back and pray my wounds open, because this is not often heard, and the media and just speak about how my life and wars, afterlives and lives were intertwined as I grow up. And of course, my experience is just a shard, a small shard, a tiny shard of what my peers and my people have suffered. So I was born in 1992, 1 year after Iraq was bombed to the pre-industrial age, as Secretary of State James Baker once said, incinerating, of course, hundreds of women and children in Al-Amriya bomb shelter in 91, in one of the many war crimes that remain unpunished, stored in the cellar of limbo. As I grew up in the 90s, the regime of humanitarian starvation, of course, and no one has been punished for what the United Nations and those who pushed for the sanctions to be sustained. The sanctions killed incalculable thousands of children who, in addition to malnutrition and absence of basic medications, were assaulted by cancers caused by the debris of war. I survived, but many died early. And to former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, the price was worth it. In 98, my first encounter with war during Operation Desert Fox would come. I stood on the rooftop as clouds of flames overcrowded the skies of Baghdad. And of course, civilians paid heavy price at the time, losing family members and carrying psychological wounds for a lifetime. Then 2003 comes and war revisits the familiar gates of Iraq. And there was fear and anticipation. I remember seeing the faces of my classmates and thinking I would never see them again. Mm-hmm. We dug wells and stored food and left it all behind for the outskirts of Baghdad. But there I could still see the B-52s running, raining hell and scarring the land and everything alive over and underneath it. And we watched with a few words and deafening silence. I remember Saddam Hussein's statue fell on a TV, ran on a battery of a car. And when we made our way home, I saw the charred carcasses of Iraqi tanks and armed vehicles, and I wondered about these soldiers. And in my neighborhood, as my father approached our house, he drove slowly because death lurked on the streets. At the time, Human Rights Watch reported that the United States and Britain used almost 13,000 cluster munitions containing nearly 2 million submunitions that killed or wounded more than 1,000 civilians, end of quote. Of course, three of those lurked in our garden, the same garden where I played football in the shade of a fig tree, a date palm, and a mulberry. Mm. And then I can go on about how my neighborhood was transformed into a war zone, basically.
I reading the piece that you wrote for Left East, you made a point earlier about how, well, for example, you quoted this Washington Post piece, the bureau chief in Baghdad says the city is thriving, and the AP reports that peace and security is all over the country. Thinking about what you dealt with in the past and the picture that you just painted there, and then today, these are the things that don't really get attention unless you look for it. You point out that environmentalist Jassim Al-Assadi was recently abducted, tortured, and released without the public knowing the perpetrator's identity. Akil Al-Nasiri, an academic, was reportedly assassinated by gunmen outside his residence. I mean, you have just many examples of this. And it compared to what we're reading in the Post, the city's thriving, there's peace and security all over the country. Can you just talk more about this? Because just to let people know what is actually happening in Iraq.
You know, Walter Benjamin, the late revolutionary philosopher, writes about progress as a storm that propels us towards a future to which our backs are turned as our eyes are fixed at a catastrophe in our yesterday that keeps piling up and hurling the debris before our feet until the debris rise skyward. So this is the progress that we are having. This is carrying the catastrophe with us and walking and leaving a trail of blood behind. Before I delve into journalists and the normalization of what I call an abnormal situation in today's Iraq, Belkis Willey of Human Rights Watch recently wrote how too many Iraqi international representatives were willing to overlook the crimes committed by state security forces in the interest of achieving, as they saw it, stability in the short term, end of quote. The United Nations, before parliamentary elections in 2021, painted graffiti on concrete barriers, inviting people to vote. You know, a bright future was waiting ahead in the future, and tomorrow. And these barriers resemble everything that is wrong in the post-invasion Iraq. They carry funeral banners, bloodstains, electoral posters for the corrupt, faces of martyred militiamen and soldiers, scars from shrapnel of past bombings. Yet the United Nations was completely fine to tell people stop and take a selfie. And it goes on with today's media reporting. I mean, Richard Engel, and if I'm pronouncing his name right, doesn't matter. He's from NBC News. Wanders around in a video he posted on Twitter like a tourist in one restaurant. And these restaurants, of course, he's saying how life is thriving, and these restaurants. In other words, that was the intention of the video. And these restaurants pop up across Baghdad with dubious capital, of course, and are often erected in violation of building codes. This is lazy journalism, of course. And this former Washington Post bureau chief, Rajiv Chandra Sikaran, thinks Baghdad is thriving. That's what he writes. And I'm quoting him, had we gone to war with a real plan for what we could do once we liberated Baghdad, Iraq would have been a different place. So he doesn't say that the war shouldn't have happened or the war was a crime. No, a better war was possible. And, you know, it's, you know, when I was in Baghdad, I used to go for long walks, and in Western Baghdad, where I lived, there were amputated footbridges and disemboweled bridges that were bombed. And they are still there. Road signs that are shredded with shrapnel. And this is how, you know, how this is what war is after lives. You know, these sites, you know, assault our psyche. But also, if you go to downtown Baghdad, and not far from the ghetto, the fortified ghetto that is, you know, a barricaded side street astride Abu Nawas, where the French embassy is and the bureaus of New York Times and other media organizations are, you know, there are children who sell tissues and bottled drinking water on the, you know, the orphans and those, you know, what war leaves behind, you know. You have in the north hundreds of thousands of people are still internally displaced. I mean, Yazidis, I mean, Sinjar is still devastated. I have a friend who opened his eyes on the doom of war, and on a phone call recently, he told me that he cannot sleep. A thousand ghost screams inside my head. So to omit all of that is to do what Haitian anthropologist Michael Michel Rolf Trullo says, the banalization of history. This is what it means.
If you don't mind, we're almost out of time, but we have a caller who's been waiting a long time, Nabil. So let's just briefly hear from Peter in San Francisco. Hi, Peter. Thanks for holding.
Thank you. And I would like to begin by saying that this is an American who apologizes from the deepest of his heart for everything that took place in Iraq. And also, very quickly, I made a phone call at that time asking how could Iraq have problems with employment and building infrastructure when there's so much to be done, and that there's plenty of people out of work who would definitely be more than happy to rebuild. My major question was perhaps from earlier, and I'd still like to know. Iran was very anti-Al-Qaeda. They came to the United States and offered them multiple times information on Al-Qaeda and how and where Al-Qaeda was located. They did not mention Iraq. So why, I still wonder why that was not made more public, and therefore perhaps an effort of actually bringing an understanding and peace to the Middle East among all the factions there.
Thanks for your call, Peter. Nabil?
So he's saying why development is not happening when there are so many people unemployed. This is the first part of the question, if I'm not mistaken. Well, first of all, because the system in violation of people's will that was erected under occupation has a priority its patronage networks to sustain and to open the door for corruption, to keep their people happy for the next elections, and they are not concerned with the with what I and others need or want. Of course, this will go on until the next uprising, hopefully bring the whole system down. And we will be celebrating, of course. I'm not familiar with... I'm not prepared to answer the question of Iran and intelligence in the United States, to be honest. But this is what I can say. I mean, Iran is back in notorious armed groups and factions who are... maintaining this irreversibly corrupt disorder, not even an order.
Well, thank you for the call and thank you for answering that, Nabil. Final thoughts. There's so much more I'd love to ask you about. We'd love to have you back. Just given your that you grew up in the middle of this, and I just can't imagine, you know, having to read these pieces that say that things are peaceful, it's better, it's I mean, even John Bolton was on NPR this morning saying he would do it all over again. Where do you think the coverage needs to go from here, Nabil? We're going to be doing a series of shows about Iraq in the coming months. What else do you think needs to be discussed? We have about a minute left.
The mental health of the people who are left behind. The fact that Middle East editors need to be sent to school, and I'm happy to develop a course for them. These hotshot journalists need to listen more. It's okay to admit that you are mistaken and that you can do better. The exploitation of local journalists need to stop. Otherwise, we will never have a full story. We'll still be hearing how beautiful the situation in Iraq and how everyone lived happily ever after. Afterwards. And these rulers, one last thought, they don't represent the people as they speak on their behalf.
Well, we would love to have you back, Nabil. Really, your writing is beautiful. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Honored.
Nabil Saleh is an Iraqi poet, journalist, and photographer. Learn more about his work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.